Hello and welcome to In Conversation With, a podcast from the Lancet Neurology. It's April 2022 and I'm Sarah Passy. I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Estrella Morenos-Rodriguez and Professor Christian Haas, who are both affiliated with the German Centre for Neurodegenerative Diseases in Munich. Their recent research on soluble TREM2 and its association with Alzheimer's disease biomarkers and cognition is published in our April issue. Estrella and Christian, it's fantastic to talk with you today. Your recent paper was conducted as part of the DIAN cohort study of people with a family history of autosomal dominant Alzheimer's disease. Can you firstly explain what makes this population so important for Alzheimer's disease research?
Sure. So one of the main reasons is that Alzheimer's disease itself begins decades before the first symptom appear. And in fact, the symptomatic stages are actually a late phase of the disease. These stages are that are mild cognitive impairment and dementia can be detected both in genetic and sporadic Alzheimer's by an appropriate clinical examination. But even the most expert evaluation detecting the mild symptoms will diagnose the disease when a considerable neuronal damage has already occurred. And we can do very little then to improve the course of the disease. In fact, it's in the presymptomatic phase when the biological events that may be more likely effective targets for disease-modifying treatments, for example, delaying the symptom onset, happen. And this presymptomatic phase is extremely difficult to detect in sporadic Alzheimer's, as only based on the valuable biomarkers we cannot ensure by now who and when is showing Alzheimer's-related cognitive symptoms when a genetic cause is not involved. And moreover, to properly study the first phases of the disease, we have to study individuals at risk for more than 20 years before symptom onset. That means to start a biomarker-based study with sequential evaluation, which include lumbar puncture, besides the venipuncture and neuroimaging techniques, in healthy general population from their 40s and 50s on, during at least 20 to 30 years. And here the problem is that such population-based cohorts now have not enough number of participants with a sufficient follow-up length. And here is where the importance to study genetic Alzheimer's comes. So in the individuals with a family history of genetic Alzheimer's disease, we can determine who in the family carries a pathogenic genetic mutation and compare his or her biomarkers with those from family members not affected by the mutation. And we can do that even from the presymptomatic stage, as we have the certainty that virtually all the mutation carriers are developing Alzheimer's disease and will do suffer cognitive decline linked to the disease due to the complete penetrance of the Alzheimer's-related pathogenic mutation. And moreover, we can calculate when, approximately, family members affected by the pathogenic mutation are starting their Alzheimer's-related symptoms based on the family mean age at onset. And that way, we can locate each individual considering their age at the moment of evaluation relative to their mean family age at onset in a temporal line representing the Alzheimer's disease evolution. And we can do that the same for the unaffected family members to locate them in the same temporal scheme. And that enables the comparison between both affected and unaffected relatives, and that this comparison will make able for us to study the different biological processes happening along the entire Alzheimer's disease evolution and not in normal aging, even during the earliest phases of the presymptomatic stage of Alzheimer's disease. And that's why the study of genetic Alzheimer's disease is crucial nowadays to understand Alzheimer's disease.
Thank you. So your study looks at the association of soluble TREM2 with other biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease and cognition. Please can you explain what made you initially consider doing research in TREM2?
Well, that was back in 2013. There were major GWAS studies conducted, and they found novel risk genes for late onset Alzheimer's disease. And to our big surprise, all these genes, or many of them, were selectively expressed in microglia only. Now, in my lab, we worked for 2 decades by that time already on the amyloid cascade, amyloid generation, and the genetics behind it. And we all know that all these mutations, like the Diane mutations, like the mutations which the Diane patients have, they affect amyloid generation. And I was totally convinced that the amyloid cascade is causing the disease. So I was quite shocked seeing all of a sudden risk factors expressed in microglia only. But on the other hand, we already knew since a long time, actually since Alois Alzheimer was working on Alzheimer's disease, that there are cells reacting to amyloid plaques. Alois Alzheimer didn't know which cell types these are, obviously, but nowadays we know it's microglia. Now, there was one gene among all these many genes, and John Hardy, a good friend of mine, pointed that out to me early on, which had mutations or sequence variants had the highest risk. And that risk was in the range of APOE4. And that gave me something to think, because APOE4 is so strong that you may see biochemical and cell biological effects. I'm a molecular biologist, so I'm interested in the immediate consequences of such mutations. So I thought, well, let's find out what the mutations are doing to TREM2, and specifically then ask the question, since I believe so much in the amyloid cascade, do these mutations fit somehow, all these microglial functions, into the amyloid cascade or not? So what we found, first of all, was right away, basically, that the mutations caused a loss of function in microglia. And a complete loss of function did something really, really interesting. So the microglia, normally, when there's a challenge, for example, an amyloid plaque, they react to it by changing their transcriptomic pattern. So they're normally in a homeostatic resting state where they surveil the environment. And if they find something bad, like, let's say, an amyloid plaque, they change their transcriptomic pattern, which then allows them to do chemotaxis, for example, cluster around amyloid plaques and start a phagocytic activity, which then helps to clear the amyloid plaques. And when you have a TREM2 complete loss of function, or even one of the really strong mutations as in a homozygous way, then these microglia don't find the amyloid plaques at all. So they are randomly distributed, they cannot cluster at all. There's reduced phagocytosis, and even the structure of the amyloid plaques changes. They look more fuzzy, as I would say, as if they would almost fall apart. And we also found that in the absence of TREM2, there's increased seeding of amyloid plaques, which will become very important later when we discuss about translation. So in principle, what we found by that time was exactly the opposite of what the microglia field was thinking. And if you look at the names and terms which we gave to the activated microglia, like disease-associated microglia, the DAM signature, or the MGND, the microglia neurodegenerative disease associated cells, that all sounds like something negative. But at the end, what turned out by our research, now many other people as well, is that this activation of the DAM signature or the MGND signature, pretty much the same, can be protective. So there are protective functions which are affected by the mutations. And we wanted to find out then, first of all, do they fit into the amyloid cascade? And at the very end, can we modulate them maybe and activate them specifically? So that's what brought me into the field, even after more than 20 years of amyloid research, which took me quite some time to understand to work on something else. But as you can tell from the work in our lab right now, we changed almost entirely to the microglial response.
So you had to develop a novel immunoassay for this study. Why was this needed? And what are the next steps for that assay?
So the development of this new immunoassay that is specifically detecting cleaved soluble TREM2 was motivated by the description of three different isoforms of soluble TREM2. Two of them were produced directly as soluble forms by alternative splicing, and not were directly related to this microglial cell autonomous response started by TREM2 that Christian has commented in the cell surface. And we don't know exactly the functions of these directly soluble isoforms that in fact could represent, as estimated by RNA expression in brain, around 25% of the soluble TREM2 potentially detected by the previous immunoassays measuring soluble TREM2. Therefore, We developed this novel immunoassay only detecting the soluble form, directly related with the TREM2-dependent microglial response, to measure specifically this cellular response and not other related responses with a non-totally understood mechanism and function. And in fact, by this novel assay, if we compare the results obtained with our previous assay, non-specifically detecting cleaved soluble TREM2 with the novel assay that is specific for cleaved soluble TREM2, then we see that the new one is more accurately discriminating between different neurodegenerative diseases and stages in the diseases, as well as between neurodegenerative disease and healthy volunteers. And here we have to say that both assays, our previous assay and the current one, correlate quite well, but still, regarding the results, we are seeing that the new one discriminates better for neuropathologies, is better discriminating for neuropathology than the previous one. And this together, that we don't know the biological meaning of the alternative soluble TREM2 forms that are potentially detected by the previous assays, makes us support the use of assays specifically detecting clipped soluble TREM2 to reach biological significant results and more accurate interpretations based on them. And regarding Alzheimer's, I think that it could be very advisable to measure specifically this clipped form of soluble TREM2 as a biomarker within the amyloid-focused clinical trials, considering the results that we had, and also in sporadic Alzheimer's as early in the disease evolution as possible.
Can you briefly explain the findings of your study? How does TREM2 fit with other biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease, such as amyloid and tau?
Let's first start and explain how we believe now that this TREM2 response and the TREM2 marker fits into the amyloid cascade. So microglial dysfunction was frequently believed as an alternative cause of Alzheimer's disease, which may even happen in parallel or even totally independent. So that some people even claimed that microglia are the cause of the disease and then everything else, including amyloid and tau, comes afterwards. And that now even started a completely new hypothesis in the field, which is called now the cellular phase of Alzheimer's disease. So we don't have only a neuronal cause, but there may be on top or likely in parallel, so we have two strains basically, an additional cause by microglia. But what Estrella showed very nicely is that the TREM2 response in the Diane patients occurs up to 21 years before they show the first symptoms. And that happens right after amyloid levels in CSF drop. And that is exactly a sign for seeding. So the first small little newborn amyloid plaques are being produced. And they are so small that amyloid PET imaging cannot even detect them by the time in the patients. So they must be at the very, very beginning of the disease. And that's what the microglia already respond to. And what we saw in earlier work in animal models was when we did seeding experiments, these little seeds are immediately detected by microglia cells. So in a TREM2-dependent manner, the microglia cluster around these little seeds and eat them away. So if you have a TREM2 loss of function mutation, they don't reach the seeds anymore, and the seeds become bigger and bigger and have really quite a different structure from the ones which we see in the presence of TREM2. So that clearly, to my opinion, indicates that microglia and the TREM2 response is an integral part of the amyloid cascade and happens super, super early. So currently, the TREM2 response is the second response in disease. The first thing what happens is, what we can measure, let's say this way, is the amyloid deposition, and then immediately the microglia react to that. Apparently, at least based on our model systems, but the protective event or mechanism, and Estrella then provided indirect data in the Diane cohort that this effect even prevents neurodegeneration, precocious shrinkage, and stabilizes cognition. So there are protective effects in response early on to the seeds. Of course, I also think that in later steps of the amyloid cascade, there are still microglial responses going on and maybe even different responses. So let's assume you have a neuron which develops a tangle based due to the induction via amyloid, then these tangle-bearing neuron may die. And that is, of course, also recognized again by microglia cells. And yeah, the whole field is currently interested in finding out if there are different responses to the different challenges which happen in the amyloid cascade. So an amyloid seed may cause a different type of microglial response than a neuron which dies due to accumulation of a tangle. But all that tells us that microglia are an integral part of the amyloid cascade. And when we look at the current clinical trials, there's at least consistent findings that amyloid-based drugs affect also tau. And since amyloid triggers also microglia, I think all that fits now very nicely all together in the amyloid cascade. And for me, as a biologist, it was obvious from the beginning on, microglia themselves, they cannot cause the disease because they need something to react to. So there must be something else in the first place which starts the disease. And to my opinion, the genetic data clearly show that it must be amyloid. But then in the second step, immediately afterwards, the microglia responds via TREM2.
Yeah, here, just to add, summarizing the results that, as Christian said, we found this relationship between the early activation of microglia by TREM2, because the increase of TREM2 was really early and only related with the lower levels of CSF A-beta-42 and not the higher increased levels in the amyloid PET uptake. And besides that, and further supporting the relationship between TREM2 and the amyloid deposition process, we saw that the longitudinal increase of soluble TREM2 exerted an effect on the relationship between the longitudinal changes of CSF A-beta-42 and the amyloid PET uptake. And that is important because both markers represent different aspects of A-beta accumulation. And in fact, until now, a scarce relationship between the longitudinal changes of both amyloid markers had been observed. And by introducing this effect of the longitudinal change of the soluble TREM2 on this relationship, we could predict the longitudinal change of a CSF A-beta-42 by the longitudinal change of amyloid PET uptake. And what we saw was that the longitudinal change of CSF A-beta-42 had also a different behavior in mutation carriers with low TREM2 response, in which CSF A-beta-42 increases after initiating the longitudinal increase of, in the amyloid PET uptake, and that fits with what Christian has said, that hyperreactive microglia is failing to condense the plaques, so more CSF A-beta-42 and more amyloid PET uptake. And in mutation carriers with a high TREM2 response, CSF A-beta-42 decreases after the longitudinal increase in the amyloid PET uptake was started. And that points also, from a clinical point of view, to soluble TREM2 in CSF as a potentially useful marker in a clinical context to interpret CSF-based and PET-based amyloid biomarkers. And here I'm changing to the relationship with tau markers, and that is a little bit more difficult, but what we saw in our study was that cross-sectionally, CSF soluble TREM2 and tau pathology-related markers in CSF correlated very well with a high correlation, but when I studied those biomarkers longitudinally, we could not see any significant relationship. So only investigating the effect of the longitudinal change of soluble TREM2 on the relationship between amyloid PET and phospho-tau in CSF, we saw that mutation carriers with a low soluble TREM2 increase showed a correlation between higher amyloid PET uptake and higher increase in CSF phospho-tau levels, which does not happen in mutation carriers with high longitudinal increase in soluble TREM2. And that led us to hypothesize, as Christian has commented too, and fitting into the amyloid cascade, a beneficial effect of TREM2 on tau-related pathology mediated by the amyloid pathology in line with recent studies in animal models. But still, we have to note here that the interpretation only based in those markers, in CSF markers, the interpretation of the relationship between soluble TREM2 and tau-related markers in CSF is still difficult. And that is probably translating a complex biological interaction difficult to capture by a CSF biomarker-based study. And just to finish and to wrap up, in line with this protective effect, of course, we saw that higher longitudinal increase rate in soluble TREM2 correlated with this slower cortical shrinkage, specifically in the precuneus, and this important correlation with this lower cognitive decline that I want to point, that was the highest correlation obtained in our study.
Final question. What might a potential role for TREM2 look like? Are there treatment implications, for example?
Yeah, so I think the role of TREM2 at the end is to trigger a protective response. And that's certainly something beneficial for patients. And that means that in principle, we should try to enhance the protective functions for a potential therapeutic treatment. So how can we do that? We have to increase TREM2 signaling. Now, TREM2 is proteolytically processed, and that's something what we found early on back in 2014 already. So the full-length TREM2 protein arrives in the cell surface, and it's only the full-length protein which can do the protective signaling. Now, the TREM2 is then cleaved by an enzyme, which is alpha secretase, so the same protease which also cleaves APP. And that stops cell autonomous signaling. So the protective cell autonomous signaling is reduced or stopped by the cleavage of alpha secretase. Then, of course, soluble TREM2 is produced, which may have its own function. That we don't know yet. But what we clearly know is that the full-length protein has a signaling function, and that signaling function is protective. So in order to prove this, we did a long time ago a proof of principle experiment. So we inhibited alpha secretase. And that leads to an enhancement of TREM2 in the cell surface, logically. And in the same moment, we found that there's more signaling activity and more phagocytic activity. So as a proof of principle, that clearly shows that inhibiting the processing increases the cell autonomous function, protective function of TREM2. But we all know, secretase inhibition is not a good idea. And alpha secretase, of course, is anti-amyloidogenic. So that's not what you do in the disease. And that was not our intention by that time. We wanted to just prove if more full-length TREM2 in the cell surface could be protective. And it is. So now the question was, how can we do that selectively? So only stabilize TREM2 and nothing else. So protease inhibition doesn't work because there are many substrates of alpha secretase and we would affect all of them. No way. So we thought about antibodies. So the hope was that we can identify an antibody which binds close to the cleavage site. So the first thing we did is we went on and did crude biochemistry, identifying the cleavage site. And luckily, this was at one very precise position and in the stalk region of the protein, which is accessible by the antibody, luckily. So then we screened for monoclonal antibodies, which bound to that region, found a couple of antibodies, and screened them for stabilizing TREM2 in the cell surface and increasing signaling. And we found one lead antibody, which has extraordinary good activities. So that antibody blocks shedding, so the cleavage is reduced dramatically. At the same moment, signaling activity goes up, proliferation and survival of microglia goes up, phagocytic activity goes up, and then we used the antibody in vivo experiments in a mouse model which produced amyloid plaques. This antibody, after a very short time of treatment, already led to a reduction of the plaque size. So that basically means that we are in principle able to therapeutically modulate protective microglial functions in vivo. To our big surprise, now several companies have also screened antibodies, so they had exactly the same idea as we. When you look at the antibodies which they identified, all of them, which are protective, bind to a region very near, if not overlapping, with our antibody. All of them do exactly the same thing. They block the cleavage of TREM2, but in the same moment, they also cluster TREM2. And then as a result, for all of them, there's increased survival and increased proliferation. And several of the studies now also show decreased amyloidogenesis. So there's more plaque removal. So I think this is one way to go. Of course, there's a long, long, long way still to go. We don't know what soluble TREM2 is doing. There's evidence that also has protective functions and that we cannot ignore. So we should better find that out. There may also be a problem that we overinduce microglia by basically bringing them in a dead end with a super high disease-associated microglial signature. But luckily, that we very recently solved. So when you basically stop hyperactivation of microglia, they can switch back to homeostatic state. So that was very good news for us. So microglia can only go from homeostatic state to disease-associated, but they can also go back. So currently, we are working together now since many, many years with our friends at Denali Therapeutics. And we hope that we can develop that antibody further on so it can go at some point into humans. So in my lab, we are specifically interested right now in double treatments. So we are starting now experiments where we use aducanumab together with our TREM2 modulating antibody and see if that facilitates aducanumab activity. And we also now check if that combination would probably prevent seeding already in the first place, so we can really prevent the entire start of the disease. This is still wishful thinking, but I hope you are on the right way.
Thank you very much. So, Christian and Estrella, thank you so much for talking to me today. So you can read Dr. Morenes Rodriguez and Professor Hass's research online now at thelancet.com. Thank you for listening to this episode of In Conversation With. Remember, you can subscribe to The Lancet Neurology In Conversation With wherever you usually get your podcasts.